Found, the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Podcasters journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you listen to or subscribe to the show on iTunes, I ask that you please leave us a five-star rating there. Also, I invite you to join me on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. Today we're going to discuss Season 7, Episode 9 of The Curse of Oak Island, titled An Eye for an Eye. And we'll do that in just a few minutes. We've got a couple of emails to get to, and then a little bit of a follow-up from last week's podcast as well. So first, let's get to the emails. Our first one comes from Roger. Roger writes, I emailed you a few weeks ago asking why people referred to Smith's Cove as being man-made. After hearing your excellent answer, I felt like an adult. I sometimes take things too literally and took the idea of the cove being man-made to mean the entire cove was man-made rather than just the beach being rearranged by people. Well, first, let me just interrupt here and say, Roger, I literally feel like a dolt, to use your word, throughout almost this entire process of researching and producing this podcast. To be truly versed in the Oak Island mystery, one needs to be, I think, an archaeologist, maybe a geologist, certainly a historian, probably an engineer. Being a mining expert wouldn't help, and I can't imagine you could do any of this without also being a mechanic. Or having knowledge in all those fields, and that's just to name a few. It's overwhelming to say the least, so don't let it get you down when you get overwhelmed by it a little bit. Let's continue with his email. Now, for the purpose of this email, I listened with interest your answer to Jim for Virginia. I must, however, take issue with your answer to the part concerning the draining of the money pit, considering it is flooded. If the money pit is totally flooded, the pit would need to be dewatered. The following is based on the idea that the vault is at the bottom of the money pit shaft. The only way, to my mind, that a back door would work is that the vault has something to block the water from falling into the shaft from the inlet tunnels. Further, based on the diagrams presented on the show of how much water is in the money pit shaft, the weight of the water would be such that the plug stopping the water from falling any further down would have to be very strong. My point is this. I'm leaning the possibility of a backdoor existing is about 50-50, perhaps less, in favor of it. Back to Smith's Cove, and this is still the email from Roger. You seem to think that the wall that was found with the tar paper attached to it, while I am not proposing it is a piece of original work, I am proposing it is possible for it to be prior to the Restalls, which you did as well. However, I will suggest it may have been used from the mid-1800s to the early 1900s. After looking into the history of tar paper, I found tar paper was being used in the middle 1800s as roofing material in the Colorado gold fields. Now, let's start by discussing this part about draining the money pit. And in order to recover the, having to drain the money pit of water in order to recover the treasure. What Roger's referring to is an email we discussed last week, which we received from Jim in Virginia and read in the last podcast about Season 7, Episode 8. If you want to know more about that and kind of not be lost here, I'd go back and listen to that podcast, get a better idea of what we talked about. I don't want to repeat it all here. Roger, I think that the point I was trying to make last week, or at least the point I had in my head that I was trying to make, was more that really I've never seen the concept of draining the water out of the shaft before recovering the treasure discussed as an element of the original engineering of this whole thing. It certainly seems logical to me that the water would need to be removed. At least at this point in time, you would think it would. But it doesn't seem that this particular idea was factored into the design put into play by the depositors. I mean, I would tend to think the original designer was using the flood tunnel system to protect the treasure from someone digging straight down the money pit shaft and then, you know, successfully digging and then getting to the vault. Whether or not the original designer also put in place a system to easily retrieve what's down there after the booby trap had been triggered, that's all just complete conjecture, really. My point is that I've seen plenty of theories about back doors. Plenty of very learned theorists offer backdoors being built into their equation. But I've never seen it about a drainage system to be used before recovering the treasure. That's kind of really my point. The theory of a backdoor is one that is popular, with those trying to figure this all out, trying to make logical sense of it all. There is a precious little evidence of a backdoor, though, if I'm honest. Even less evidence to suggest this whole system also includes a drain that could be triggered by the returning depositors. But, I mean, honestly, no one really knows for sure. These type of things are, you know, like I said, up to this point, just really conjecture. It's just those of us trying to make sense of all of it, really. Also, the original designers probably did not consider the idea of someone performing multiple core drilling holes, digging horizontal bypass shafts, or the myriad other things done at the Money Pit during the 200-plus year history of the hunt when they engineered this whole thing. I suppose if the vault was placed deep enough under the flood tunnels, my guess is that it could certainly hold up, under the weight of the flood. But once you factor everything else in, meaning after everything previously, done by searchers, once you factor that all of that into this, who knows, what kind of shape any of this would be in at this point. My best guess is much of what the depositors built has long since been destroyed, and we'll never really know the true extent of all this. Also, Roger, I wouldn't worry too much about the diagrams the show presents. Those are really just theories at best, believe me. And also, I tend to agree with your assessment of the chance of a backdoor existing. I would say about 50-50 is correct, or right around there. It certainly makes a lot of sense. And that alone is really all that puts it up to 50-50. But like I said, there's been precious little evidence of any such backdoor up to this point. And much of the evidence anybody does point to is really just assumption at best. Now, about Smith's Cove and the tar paper. Now, that's a really great segue into our next email, which comes from Tim, who asks, quote, "I am really puzzled about this. If you were building an underwater wooden box in the ocean, why would you cover the front of it in tar paper? Isn't that sort of useless? It can't really be considered waterproof." Well, so what Tim and Roger are both asking about is this new previously undocumented structure found earlier this season in Smith's Cove. The wooden box we've seen a lot of in the last few episodes. That's way out past the, close to this new bump out, the end of this bump out of the cofferdam out in Smith's Cove. When the wood on the face of this was first uncovered, the seaward side of it, if you will, was initially found covered in what was a layer of tar paper. They all saw it, all pointed at it, all said, "Hey, there's tar paper." This leads me to conclude this was certainly not built pre-1795, built before the discovery of the Money Pit, and more likely is from one of the treasure hunters working on the island in the 20th century. I've said this a few times. And I've pointed out many, many times, I'm sure I'll point it out again before the show is over, that this is an important factor to keep in mind. And as we've talked about a lot of times in this podcast, even the best and most diligent treasure hunters have failed to document their work one time or another. Now, Roger was correct. Tar paper was, for all intents and purposes, invented, at least in this country, somewhere in the mid-1800s, and it was first made popular on roofs of what we would charitably call cabins, but were essentially just sort of temporary housing structures built and used by, during the gold rush out west, by the guys out there, the 49ers, so to speak. These guys had to move with the gold. So the cabins they built were not designed to be anywhere near permanent. Laying a coat of tar paper over the top of it was easier than building a traditional roof. Now, the California gold rush was right around 1850, so we have to give it a few years before tar paper becomes a prevalent tool further east and then adapted for different uses and applications. So that's essentially why I put a kind of a best guess in the early 20th century, though 50 years might be just a little too much. But it certainly doesn't have to be that exactly, But here's the thing. Your question is, isn't it sort of useless? And my answer is that perhaps at this point, looking back at all this in hindsight, from what we know now, it is really, you would think, nowhere near the most effective thing to use for waterproofing a cofferdam or a shaft or surrounded by the ocean. But I think you could see what they may have, why they may have tried using it. I mean, tar paper of that kind was essentially used for, what we would now call weatherproofing. Now, weatherproofing and waterproofing are two very different things, but maybe not so much back then. I think we can at least see what they might have been going after here with using it. And it was probably just, one outer layer plus maybe some clay, and who knows what else might have washed away over the years. In an age before power tools and heavy equipment, before epoxy and caulking, when getting large sheets of steel, you know, was likely not a financial option at all, can't we at least see what they were trying to do with the tar paper and why it might be there? And who knows? You know, maybe they put it there and it failed them. I mean, depending on the timing of when it was built, this may have been used as, you know, employed as just sort of a best guess with just sort of a little information on what this, you know, essentially new product could do. And they got it wrong. Now, whether or not it is a good tool for waterproofing is truly not the point of all this. And I need to make that clear. The point is, it was there. Regardless of what it was used for or how effectively it was employed, the fact remains it was there. And that is really the only important point in all this. Its presence alone, regardless of its application or effectiveness, is what helps us date this structure. Well, you know, thanks for the question, Tim. I think I would also add that I doubt we are going to hear much more, if anything, about this tar paper moving forward. And that's a shame, because it really might help solve the puzzle of who built this structure, but it doesn't seem to be something that they're spending too much time on. Oh, and before we wrap up this email section here, let me just mention one other thing from the first email by Roger. The reason I agree with Rick to some extent that this structure looks something like the Restalls might have built is because Robert Restall took a lot of photos of his work, and you can really see some elements that point to their handiwork in what we're seeing here being uncovered. But sure, the Restalls didn't invent these methods of what they did, and much of what they did was done with, you know, planks and timbers. So the possibility of being pre-Restall certainly exists as well. Gentlemen, thank you for your emails, and also thank you for listening, guys, and the kind words about the show. Keep all your emails and ideas coming. I love discussing these things. I love hearing what you guys are thinking about. If you'd like to email me your thoughts or questions as well, you can do so at digginoakisland@gmail.com. All right, so now for the follow-up. In last week's podcast, we talked about the latest theory presented during episode 8 in another of these war room sessions we have seen quite a few of over the years. This one dealt with French painter Nicolas Poussin and was presented by a man named Corian Maul. While working on last week's podcast, I mean, maybe this came across, I hope it did, it really struck me just how chopped up and how I felt, you know, poorly the show presented Mr. Maul's theory. I mean, I, for one, came out of this war room session with really no idea if this theory he was presenting had any credibility at all. I mean, and that wasn't his fault. And since Mr. Maul has not written a book or anything like that, there was no way for me to do my own research and analysis and present that to you. So after I wrote and recorded the show last week, I thought to myself that maybe I would spend some time, you know, in the following days trying to get in contact with Mr. Maul and see if I could do something of a follow-up and maybe just get a little more information so we can all get a, you know, a lot better idea of this theory's validity. Well, before I can do that, guess who emailed me a couple of days later? That's right, Corian Maul. We talked for a while via email and through some messaging as well, and I just want to relay some of what he said because he really offered some terrific clarifying information to me that I think you will find very interesting. First, from his email, he writes, quote, "Dave, this is Corian Maul speaking, the crackpot of the Oak Island episode triptych." I mean, I really have to stop using that phrase. I just, you know, I really feel like a jerk now. But I guess he doesn't seem to mind the joke all that much anyway. So anyway, I digress. Back to the email. He writes, "There's some things I'd like to share. One is that I was actually approached by the Oak Island team through a research assistant. They asked me if I thought there could be a link between Poussin and the island as his name kept popping up in the research and the theories they are presented with. I had never paid much attention to the island." And then he adds, the reason they contacted me is my 20-plus years of research in the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, in which Poussin figures quite prominently. I was called in as an expert." We'll end the quote there for a second. I think this is a really important distinction here. I mean, talking about how he got to be on the show. Maul is not someone who comes to the Curse of Oak Island and its viewers already convinced of his own theory. I'm not sure how often this has happened on the show, but he was actually approached by either the producers or the cast, doesn't really matter which, to look into a possible Poussin connection, and is essentially just here reporting his findings. I have to admit, I'm absolutely fascinated by this idea, and also really impressed that the show is essentially doing its own research into possible clues and new theories, and by doing so, reaching out to somebody with 20 plus years of experience and research into the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau. Maybe someday we'll get Mr. Mullen to talk about that, but I don't want to get too distracted by the Rennes Le Chateau stuff now. See the Da Vinci Code, I guess, if you want to kind of get an idea of that. But anyway, Mr. Maul continues, quote, "They edited the war room session in a way that makes it look like, I believe, out of the blue, that the Ark of the Covenant is buried on the island. I don't. What I told him is that if indeed a secret was hidden on these paintings, these would be the clues. And there are indeed more than they show. And if I would live in the 17th century and I would have to draw a pentagram on the ground with a few people, I would need three marker stones like in Nolan's Cross." End quote. That's all great information for me, Mr. Maltz, for sure, especially as a follow-up to last week's podcast. If you remember, one of the things I was truly flummoxed by was how they just sort of pulled the Ark of the Covenant into the theory with essentially nothing to back it up. Mr. Maltz is pointing out clues in the painting, and then out of thin air almost, we just sort of jumped to the Ark. But like I said, you could obviously tell that much of what was being said was really left on the editing room floor. And also here, too, I would encourage you, dear listener, to go back and watch last week's episode again. If you don't recall what he means about the pentagram, it's very hard to explain in an audio format, so go take a look. Now, it's this next part here that I really want to get into. He explains, quote, "In your podcast, you ask why Poussin would hide a secret that he knew of in a painting. The answer is because his employers asked him to. It wouldn't have been his secret. These works weren't for public consumption, but were kept in the private quarters of the Pope, where only he and a very select group of people would see them. The Sun King, Louis XIV, went out of his way to get this painting and put it in his private bedroom, where it remained until Napoleon put it in the Louvre, not until 1805. End quote. Great answer to my question for sure, but I felt I just needed more. So later I asked him to expand it a bit. I wanted to know why would his employer want him to do this? I mean, if it's truly a secret, worth all the effort required to bury it on an uncharted island half a world away on a continent that was, you know, for all intents and purposes, a rumor at this point, why would anyone want to leave breadcrumbs for the entire world to see? I wasn't concerned so much about Poussin specifically, but more just about the idea generally of wanting to do this. I mean, the best way to keep a secret is by actually keeping it secret. Not having clues painted for all to see, and thus running the risk of someone, you know, connecting the dots and someone not connected to the treasure or the burying of it, deciphering these clues, and then finding the secret and recovering the loot or whatever it might be. So Corian answers this way. That's a very good question. I think there can be some elements to the answer. First of all, the info wasn't for all to see, as it was never meant to be on public display. There might be a fourth or fifth Shepherds of Arcadia that didn't make it to the public eye, and we would never know. Poussin worked alone. He was an absolute exception in not having a studio with apprentices. He did everything himself. We'll end the quote there for a second. I say this all the time. The most maddening thing for me about many of Oak Island's best and most popular theories is just when I think I'm on to something that proves this is all hokum, just when I'm ready to call BS on this one, someone much smarter and much better informed than me comes along and successfully, you know, covers up all the holes I just tried to poke into it. And Corey Maul is definitely much smarter and better informed on this, and that answer certainly opens up an avenue I didn't think of. Anyway, he continues. Quote, "Secondly, perhaps whatever the secret was did only have to be kept from people that didn't know how to read the painting. If you show the Starbucks logo to someone who lived off the grid in the Amazon all his life, he might not even recognize there's a woman in the middle of it. Poussin was an early Rosicrucian slash Mason. You'll see that in Tuesday's episode." This is the episode that we just watched, so we'll get to that in a second. A group of like-minded initiates might have recognized what he put in. And that might not have been a problem because of 3, not everything is on there. Perhaps the painting says, I tego arcana die, behold, I keep the secrets of God. And I think this is pronounced right, Gitte Neo Arcadia, travel to New Arcadia. Perhaps the Midas painting tells you to look for a gold river. The paintings are clearly related. They feature the same river. The pentagram is accepted by the art historians. On X-ray, you can see Poussin painted the staff before the tomb. If you add it all up, you might get the idea that there is a religious secret hidden in New Arcadia near a gold river or gold-bearing river. Without internet and proper maps, you'd have a very hard time to conclude you needed to be on Oak Island at the time. The clues put you in within a few miles or something like that, which leads me to 4 and his conclusion. I think these paintings were made to show off. Look at me, I know a secret. And if you look very hard, you'll know approximately what it is and where it is, but not precisely, end quote. Well, Mr. Mullen, I hope you're listening. That is a good answer, and as good an answer as anyone can ask for. I can't say I'm totally convinced, but the idea of someone who might know a secret and just isn't very good at keeping it makes all the sense in the world to me. Hey, remind me never to tell Nicolas Poussin anything important. But it's this very concept, this idea of hiding a secret of such possible religious and historic significance as to essentially rewrite modern human history in something like a painting or a manuscript or star map or that kind of thing, it's that idea that just stumps me. And it's not just the question of why anyone would do this, why anybody would leave breadcrumbs, so to speak. The other question I inevitably ask when seeing one of these theories is, are we really seeing secret clues left by the painter or the author or whoever? Or are we, in fact, just trying to fit clues into something where maybe clues never existed in the first place? What I always point to here as an example of this idea is the work of the Norwegian organist Petter Amundsen. You've seen him on the show before, and we've discussed him here on this podcast a few times. He's the man who believes Francis Bacon was the true author of all of Shakespeare's works, and that he hid clues to the Oak Island mystery in the original published folio of Shakespeare's plays. The easiest gateway into this theory is a documentary called Cracking the Shakespeare Code, which I think you can watch on one of the streaming services, either Amazon or Netflix, I think. I think that's where I saw it. As I watch Amundsen go through all the clues he finds and things like page numbers, capitalizations, placement of specific words, and that kind of thing, I can't help but wonder if these things he's showing us are actually clues to a secret, or is Mr. Amundsen just so convinced of his theory that he's kind of subconsciously finding clues where they don't really exist. Think of someone looking for a ghost and thinking that the natural sounds of a house, settling or that kind of thing are indeed evidence of a haunting. Now, I'm not saying that's what Corian Maul is doing here. I simply don't know. At least not yet. But having said all that, there's obviously a lot more to talk about. As you might have gleaned from what I read earlier in his communication, Mr. Mullen was not only on last week's episode, and as you probably know by now, this week's, which we're about to discuss, but he's also on more episodes this season. So we have a lot more information to come to us. And even though I'm asking these sort of skeptical questions about what he's presented so far, I'm only doing that in the interest of responding to all this in sort of real time. We have a lot more information to come. So let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back with this week's episode review. Okay, since we're already talking about Corian Maul, let's start this review with the latest War Room session. Corian is in a new shirt, so it would seem this week's and last week's scene were not just the same scene artfully edited. Also to that end, Corian is joined this time by a researcher named Chris Morford. Speaking of shirts, Chris is wearing a shirt from the legendary Key West bar called Sloppy Joe's. I feel like a fashion editor here. That's an image of Ernest Hemingway on his shirt there, if you didn't pick that one up. Now, I don't know much about Mr. Morford, but I can say this. He knows a good bar when he sees one, for whatever that's worth. I imagine we'll learn even more about Chris in the coming weeks. But for this episode, He is introduced to us only as a researcher and apparently a research partner of some kind with Gorian Maul. Now, even though I mentioned these are two different War Room sessions, this week's is very much a continuation of last week's scene, really, when you look at it. Last week, Gorian Maul presented his idea that perhaps French painter Nicolas Poussin might have hidden clues on the location of the Oak Island treasure in three of his paintings. In this episode, he is basically plotting that location onto a map of the island, and also offering a few more clues as to how he came to this conclusion. The location is right around what Marty Lagina calls the Eye of the Swamp, just at the top of the triangle, so to speak. It's an area not yet explored much, and Marty also points out to the gentleman that this is probably the single most difficult place to dig on the island. Now, Maul and Morford use a pentagram plotted on the painting to come to this specific location. Points in this pentagram are then plotted onto the map of the island by Steve Guptill, essentially using Nolan's cross as a guide. And once again, here we have what I can only phrase as an incredible lack of details presented to the viewers. Details that are key in really understanding the logic behind all this. First, let me just offer up a couple questions. Why Nolan's cross? Is there a reason to believe Poussin knew the cross or had some knowledge that someone placed the boulders in these locations? He would have had to in order to make it all work. He would have had to have known exactly where they were in order to make this all work. Also, why are some of the points in the cross not used in the process of locating the treasure? This seems to me like an enormous task to move a multi-ton boulder or two across the rocky ground of a North Atlantic island just for no real reason no reason is offered. We'll just leave it at that, for no real reason. Second, why is the pentagram offset from the painting? If you watch the show, you'll see some of the points on the pentagram are not actually within the boundaries of the painting itself. How does this all work? It's perhaps a boring detail for some, but not for us trying to get a better idea of this theory and how it is practically applied. Now, I'm not saying there aren't answers to these things. I'm just throwing the questions out there. And finally, how did the Knights Templar fit into all this? Poussin was not a medieval painter. He worked in the 17th century. So are we talking about knowledge he gained from the actual Templars themselves doing this work, the digging on Oak Island centuries earlier? Or are we talking about one of the many groups often lumped into this nebulous category of descendants of the Templars? It can get frustrating sometimes for me just how this distinction between actual Templar Knights and other later groups can be ignored by the show when presenting these theories that involve somehow, whether directly or tangentially, the Knights Templar. Also, I just want to point out one more thing. I cannot find any mention of this area of the swamp being called the Eye by anyone before Marty Lagina, and certainly not the all-seeing Eye. If I'm incorrect about this, please email me. Now, while I understand an explanation of the place the image of the all-seeing Eye holds throughout the history of our country and also the history of certain, in air quotes, secret societies, I see how such an explanation makes for good television. I don't see a connection, really, historically, to Oak Island Swamp, other than as a nice turn of phrase. You know, just because Marty Lagina calls it the Eye does not mean it has always been considered the all-seeing eye of Oak Island. Swamp has changed quite a lot over the years. Even looking at photos from the last 100 years can show you just how much it's really changed. Who knows if this eye even existed centuries ago in any form like the one we see now. Now, having said that, perhaps this eye was in fact man-made, which you'll learn about later in the show, a little teaser for you. But just like last episode, I have to give this episode's presentation in the War Room a grade of incomplete. We clearly have much more to learn, and the show is obviously trying to connect this theory with the work in the swamp that might be shown in future episodes, setting the groundwork, so to speak, for what's to come. We have a lot more to talk about in the swamp today, but before we do that, let's head over to Smith's Cove. So let's talk now for a second about the work continuing in Smith's Cove. We mentioned the wooden box already in the email section of this podcast. And in this episode, we learned that the team has decided to almost basically suspend work on that particular structure in order to search the undisturbed area directly in front of the wharf or slipway. Perhaps another clue that they're convinced this wooden box is indeed searcher-built. Heavy equipment operator Billy Gephardt is once again behind the wheel of his excavator, and he's digging in front of the slipway when he notices some of the rocks there seem to be somewhat out of place, looking like they may have been piled up on this spot on purpose. Essentially not a natural formation, if I'm making sense here. And that idea is confirmed moments later when they also find a large timber buried in there as well. So Gary Drayton gets his metal detector and he detects in the spoils of the dig. And though he doesn't find anything that seems too interesting that's made of metal, he does pull out two of these large wooden pegs, the kind of pegs that you would use to build and secure an old wooden structure together if, you know, iron spikes or nails weren't available to you. The team also notices what might be clay packed in there as well. Now, keep these things in mind as we go a bit further here. We'll come back to them. After the team removes more and more earth, we get to see just how massive these timbers are that they're finding here. I mean, this is certainly a substantial structure, a big structure made of big wood timbers. Rick Lagina notes that along with, you know, those wooden pegs that I mentioned, this thing they're looking at here kind of looks a lot like the U-shaped structure, the if you remember that from last year. But the really fascinating thing Rick observes is that it might, in fact, be an oak timber. Now, why is this significant? Well, remember the platforms laid in the 10-foot intervals in the original money pit? Well, they were also made of oak, reportedly. The money pit also had plenty of clay used on the walls and in its construction in various ways. Now, does this mean this new structure in Smith's Cove is, in fact, related to the money pit, perhaps built by the same people? Well, I don't think we can jump to that conclusion just yet. One thing I would like to know is if anything else built on the island also used oak for its construction. That might give us a better idea of what our options really are here. But there certainly is more than enough wood, including a nice big intact timber, to test and date. So let's reserve judgment on this one until we hear just a bit more information. Now, this episode begins with a war room session to discuss the next steps in the search for the original money pit, after the team has apparently discovered, or at least believes it has discovered, Shaft 2. Researcher Doug Kroll tells us what we have discussed here before, that Shaft 2 was dug around 1804 by the Truro Company about 14 feet to the east of the money pit. When they reached a depth of around 110 feet or so, they tunneled horizontally towards the money pit to try and reach the vault, the treasure vault, by bypassing the flooding that was above them. They made it about 12 feet before the water from the money pit burst in, nearly drowning everyone down there working. The interesting thing to me here in this story that Kroll is telling us is that he calls it, quote unquote, the lore of Shaft 2. Now, I love that word, lore, because it really is telling. It really shows us just how much actual fact may or may not be in these early stories and how much might just be lore. Kroll has spent years researching this stuff. No one knows that better than he does. But the show doesn't often use expressions like that to cast what I consider to be the appropriate level of doubt over the historical information from past searchers and digs. The team also kicks around the idea that the treasure itself, or at least part of the treasure, might be in this horizontal tunnel as a result of the flooding bursting in from the treasure vault, then thus spilling it out across this new shaft as it kind of bursts through. This is an idea that's been kicked around a lot over the years, that the treasure is not exactly where it was originally deposited. This is either as a result of floodwaters like this or various shafts collapsing. I mean, the money pit completely collapsed at one point, or things being pushed out of place by drillings and other search methods. You remember the idea of the chapel vault being pushed out of the way by one of those big cans that the Laginas put down there. It's just another element to complicate all of this even further and to make the historical information less and less less and less worthy of discussing sometimes here with this stuff. As you must know by now, I lean towards the idea that most of what was dug this close to the money pit before the mid-1960s was in fact destroyed by a man named Robert Dunfield in a 100-foot-wide crater. Now, I've discussed this over and over again on the show, so go back and listen to a last couple of shows and you'll know exactly what I mean. But I have to tell you this, folks. There are many researchers, people have been doing this much longer than I have, who don't believe that that is in fact the case. They believe Dunfield was way off the mark with finding the money pit and actually dug his crater far enough away so as to not have too much of an effect on this area around what is now being called Shaft 2. Also, keep in mind, Dunfield's crater was cone-shaped by the time he finished it. It was reportedly 100 feet wide at its mouth, and that measurement is just an estimate and most likely an exaggeration. And it got more and more narrow to the point where it was very narrow as it descended down. So it is, you know, logically very possible that if he was far enough off the mark in where he thought the money pit was, that Shaft 2 might just be there intact, or at least some of it, especially at a depth of 100 feet, where Dunfield's cone must have only been a few yards wide. Now, I mention this because this episode really shook me and really kind of leaned me towards this idea that I'm not correct on what Dunfield may have done. And the real evidence of this may indeed be that, you know, if the real evidence that Shaft 2 may indeed be intact comes from geologist Terry Matheson in this episode. And side note, folks, for the love of God, people, put this man in the war room sessions. I mean, a geologist, it's exactly what those discussions need. The team relies on this man as the front line in all these digs. And anyway, I digress. Terry says the ground leading down to the depth of 90 feet or so where they're drilling is undisturbed earth. That's the word he uses, undisturbed. Now, here's the thing. I'm 100% certain a man like Terry Matheson, with his background and his education and his experience, can easily tell the difference between undisturbed ground and an area that has been previously dug out with teams of excavators and then refilled back in with dirt and wood and everything else Dunfield destroyed in his path. So it would appear that perhaps my assessment of the area is wrong. Perhaps Dunfield managed to miss Shaft 2 altogether. I mean, there really is no other explanation I can think of. Now, can we be that lucky? Man, I hope so. Rick says during these money pit scenes, quote, we know we definitely found Shaft 2. Now, some of you might say that might be some of an exaggeration. Maybe, maybe not. The wood dating from the episode from last episode that they found in what they thought was Shaft 2 and the clues that they're finding now in these drilling samples are certainly compelling. So for the purposes of following this storyline for the remainder of the season, I think what I've decided to do is sort of put aside the Dunfield angle. I'm not going to mention that anymore. I've mentioned it a lot. Let's just let this all play out without referring too much to that moving forward. Call me an optimist if you will, but I'm going to go with Terry here and assume that this is, in fact, undisturbed ground. And now, folks, I'm once again officially excited about this part of the project. Finally, we head back to the swamp. And the return of the swamp doctor to Oak Island. Dr. Ian Spooner is the head of the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at Arcadia University in Nova Scotia, and he specializes specifically in analyzing environments just like this, just like the swamp on Oak Island. Now, let's just review Spooner's work so far on the island that we've seen. Back in episode 2, he did some soil testing on the swamp to determine its possible age. And then in episode 3, came to the war room to tell the team that the results from those samples indicated that perhaps the swamp is only something like 300 to 400 years old. Now, in this episode, Spooner is back with some students from Arcadia, I would assume, to do some testing in the area Marty calls the eye. Now, I told you we'd get back to Marty's all-seeing eye. Here we are. At the end of the episode, Spooner is in the war room again. And you know when an episode ends with a war room session, it might be a good one. And in fact, this one is. This time, Spooner delivers what, to me at least, was one of the most intriguing war room presentations I've seen in quite some time. Now, Spooner seems genuinely impressed and genuinely intrigued by the results he came up with here. And so am I, and so should everyone else be. What he finds is evidence of what he calls, quote, significant human activity, quote, in the years between 1680 and 1700, a very specific and very exact time. And this is from a sample taken in the area that is now Marty's eye of the swamp. The idea I get here is that the evidence suggests the ground was essentially dug out or something along those lines. Now, here's something important to note. Known European activity essentially began in Nova Scotia in 1605, but it's important to note that Native American tribes had been there for centuries before then, specifically the Mi'kmaq, who certainly lived and moved and worked throughout this area quite a bit during those years and before, and were probably, most likely, on Oak Island. Sure, it's unusual to find quote-unquote significant human activity on what was almost certainly a rather remote island during this time period, but it doesn't by itself totally indicate anything all that crazy, at least not to me. There were people there. Let's not forget this. What I would like to know is whether this ground was indeed submerged during that time frame, meaning was this activity performed on ground that was underwater, you know, in under the swamp, or was it at this point dry? Fred Nolan's son Tom is in the war room for this, being that his father spent many, many years investigating the swamp. He points out that no matter how hard they tried to pump this area of the eye, it just could not keep it dry. It led them to believe that perhaps this whole thing might have been spring-fed. Now, on a side note, if that's true, that would certainly put the kibosh on this whole two-island theory that many people believe in, including Fred Nolan, anyway. I thought that was an interesting little tidbit. Let's get back to Dr. Spooner. The information he gives us here is fascinating. And if there's any way to get a better idea of exactly what this activity he's talking about might have been, man, that would be great information. He says again that all this data, quote, points to something pretty complex happening at this time, end quote. Now, I wish they would have told us more details on why he comes to that conclusion, what kind of stuff was done, what kind of work was done, but that's just the way of things with these editors, I guess, sometimes. Maybe one day they need to release an uncut version on DVD for us Oak Island geeks, I don't know. But the real stunner comes next when Dr. Spooner reveals that his tests indicate the swamp, quote, initiated around 1200 AD, end quote. Here he's talking about an area he labeled S2, which is more towards the middle of the swamp, more towards the area of the swamp we're familiar with, not Marty's all-seeing eye. Now, this is strange, because that is quite a bit older than the 300 to 400 years he offered up just a few episodes back. I'm curious as to what caused this change. Perhaps it's just a different location, but again, we're not given these details. But wait a second. Did he just say 1200 AD? You know what that means, folks. Yep, those pesky Knights Templar are back again. So let me just put this all into context here a bit. I suppose the pattern of thought they're trying to develop here is the Knights Templar came to Oak Island and built the swamp as part, just one part, of their elaborate system to hide either the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant or whatever other religious artifacts and treasures they might have had. Now, the first issue with this is such a conclusion simply ignores the 1680 to 1700 date we discussed only minutes earlier. But honestly, it doesn't make any sense to me, at least, even in just the context of the Templar theory. The theory is based around the idea that the Templars recovered many of these priceless religious artifacts that I mentioned before during their time in the Holy Land while they were fighting in the Crusades. As the story goes, warrants were then issued for their arrest by the King of France, but a group of knights knew these warrants were coming, grabbed the artifacts, and skipped town, sailing to, you know, perhaps a sanctuary in Scotland, and then eventually on to the New World, where they hid their most important stuff, presumably, I guess, at the bottom of a 200-foot-deep pit in Canada. But the Templars were really at the height of their power at 1200 AD. In fact, they wouldn't be completely disbanded or for more than 100 years, officially dissolved by the Vatican in 1312 after a few years of hunting and fighting, so to speak. Why would they have struck out across the Atlantic Ocean to unknown lands and take the very real risk of losing these most precious artifacts in the process? when they were more than capable of hiding and defending them at home in Europe. It really just doesn't make any sense to me, but who am I to rain on Gary Drayton's Templar parade here? Now, I know we do have the Zena Halpern theory, and that's what they discuss mostly in this scene, and it's one that's very important to Rick. One of the elements of Ms. Halpern's work surrounds possible documentation of a Templar voyage around 1180 to the New World. Now, whether or not that voyage was for the purpose of hiding religious artifacts is not clear. I find it interesting, though, that during this scene, Rick points at a map on the screen he says depicts the landing from 1179. But if you pause and read the map, it clearly says landing 1347. Not sure why that is. Let me admit here, I know precious little of Halpern's theory, and I have read her book, The Templar Mission, but I'm just not totally convinced. I'll admit there's a lot more to learn on this whole thing, and her theory is very complex and even evolving as we go along. So let's not fall down that rabbit hole just now. Having said all of that, having cast all this shade on this, the War Room session was fascinating. No two ways about it. We can't forget that Dr. Spooner ends by saying all of what he finds here points to, quote, incredible manipulation over the past 1,000 years, end quote. Is the swamp, or at least Marty's eye, actually man-made? It certainly seems the doctor is leaning that way. And when a scientist says something like incredible manipulation or significant human activity after collecting and analyzing his data, you know he believes in it. Spooner has nothing to gain by sticking his neck out about this, and quite a lot to lose if he's proven wrong. As this year goes on, I really hope we get to hear and learn even more from the Swamp Doctor. So that should just about do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. I ask, as always, if you please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you do enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen. For some reason, I can't really understand. That helps to get the word out on the show. My heartfelt thanks, as always, to everyone who has done so already. There's some great and very flattering reviews on there. Thank you so much for it. And also, if you know anyone who's interested in Oak Island, please feel free to share the podcast with them as well. It's always nice to have new listeners. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at Digging Oak Island. It's a nice place there to sort of follow the show, to get updates on the show and leave your comments. Also, you know, connect with fellow listeners. It's a great way to do that. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments that you would like to send just directly to me and not via social media, you could do so with an email. You can find me at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.